If you see something, say something. At Reply, weird things come with any weird story you find on the web, and you can help make weirdthings.com even weirder.
Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com. Hey, buddy. Justin here. My buddy, I mean everybody listening, because you're all my friends. You know who else is my friend? Tom Merritt. You might know him from Tech News Today, Sword and Laser, but he also does a podcast called FSL Tonight. With who? Me. That's who. It's a fictitious sports league comprised of all sorts of science fiction and fantasy characters. Now, that might seem a little confusing, but the good news is there's a video where we explain it. You can go on over to Kickstarter.com and just search FSL Tonight, and you'll come up to a page where we explain everything about the league. Oh, also it's on Kickstarter because we're having a Kickstarter. Our third season is going to be completely ad-free, and we got some really sweet perks if you are interested in this concept or already listen to the podcast. So head on over to Kickstarter, search for FSL Tonight, and back it if you want. If you don't, no sweat. Seriously, it's not a problem. Don't worry about it. It's very niche, you know. I mean, I'm not begging you for money here. Seriously, I am kind of, though. Please, give me money.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Yeah, that's me. You heard it.
So, Justin.
Yeah.
Let's get started with the weekly SpaceX update.
Let me tell you a story, Andrew. I just got back from South by Southwest, and at South by Southwest, Elon Musk was there. And I want you to explain, because I think you can do it for our science literate listeners, a more justice on exactly what he showed in terms of footage for what he has, what SpaceX, where SpaceX is in their quest for a reusable rocket. Can you describe the footage that he premiered there at South by and is now online?
Well, and just a real quick backstory, he had tweeted out a while ago that they were going to be doing another test of the Grasshopper launch platform, which is basically the first stage of the Falcon 9 rocket.
Yeah.
And he had said that they were going to do a test, and it was called the Johnny Cash Hover Slam.
Yeah.
And the word slam does not imply a vote of confidence as far as how this thing is going to land.
No.
And it was...
I think you had mentioned on this podcast that he had even come out and said this one might leave a crater.
Yeah, said we might leave a crater at that. And what they were supposed to be testing was, I believed, the onboard guidance system, the ability for the rocket to control itself to go up and do a hover, the hover part of the test, and maintain that hover for a few seconds and then land back down with helicopter-like precision. So at South by Southwest, he was a keynote speaker, and before this happened, Justin and I talked about when were we going to see this Grasshopper test, and
yeah.
I was hesitant to think that we would see this particular test before the Dragon came back down from the ISS, because I'm thinking, given the media has a penchant for liking to sort of jump all over, you know, anything, anytime one of our heroes or one of our giants does something kind of big and maybe stumbles, perhaps that he wasn't ready to have that kind of criticism if the test was unsuccessful. But it's a controlled test. Nobody knew the thing even took place until after it happened. And he brought the footage with him on stage at South by South by. And what we saw was the Falcon 9, or the Grasshopper rather, take off, which is 10 stories tall. It's a 10-story tall rocket. It's 100 feet. Take off from the pad and go up, and we've seen the test before. We saw a few foot test, and then we saw a slightly larger test, and this went up 266 feet. And to give you an idea of how tall that is high as the crown of the Statue of Liberty, including the pedestal. So if the rocket took off from Liberty Island, It would, or you know, from the front of the statue, it could have hovered over and landed on the other side. That's a 10-story building we're watching do this. A 10-story tall structure did this, took off, hovered for a few seconds, and it landed with pinpoint precision back on the launch pad, which is an important step.
Is, and we've seen videos like this before where the rocket has lifted off and then landed back on the ground. This was the first time, for whatever reason, that I watched that footage, and it looked like a spaceship. It looked like the way that we imagine and have illustrated in science fiction spaceships taking off and landing. This was the first time that you looked at that, and it was almost, in a way, and I use the word unimpressive very, very with heavy qualifiers, only because it looked so much like we would see in a CGI movie. That you know, it was as if you trotted out a dinosaur and it's like, wow, it looks exactly like the one in Jurassic Park. You know, it was amazing to see and know that it was real. And I had you explain all of that just so I could qualify that on the streets of South by Southwest, the most popular topic, the hot bit of news on everybody's lips, was Grumpy Cat.
Yes, free Grumpy Cat.
that Grumpy Cat was at the Mashable tent. Free Grumpy Cat? No, we should take a picture with Grumpy Cat. But I think he's upset. I think he's enjoying the attention. Folks, we spaceships are real. Like,
well, and context is everything, and you'll hear people complain that after the last launch, I saw this on Twitter, hey, we just launched a rocket, yet nobody's talking about it. And in order for something to be newsworthy or for people to go, oh, wow, it either one has to be something new, or two, it has to sort of, you know, I guess everything has to be new. It has to sort of set some new precedent that we haven't seen done before. And I'm fascinated by every time I'm fascinated by the idea of something becoming routine that we thought was unlikely. And the advent of this is we've seen test footage of rockets for years, and I think it's hard for people to fully appreciate what's going on and what we're watching, because you see a rocket take off and then land back down, and it's not just the technological and it's the economic implications that we've talked about on this podcast before. And I don't think it's quite fully dawned on people that that's where the space age is really happening. It's in McGregor, Texas. It's on this launch pad. That's where the real promise of the future comes from. And it's going to take a while to work its way into our consciousness.
I mean, as well as everything else that will, come up around it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if you can hear my new cockatiel, Dr. Bird, is singing the Angry Birds theme, which he's picked up and learned. It is absolutely just a monumental step forward from, if you wanted to go to space, you previously and now currently need a space agency. Mm-hmm. The difference is now you might just need a spaceship, and that's massive.
Oh, for sure. And it's going to take a while for people to really wrap their heads around what's going on. And that's going to happen eventually as it goes higher and with supersonic, et cetera. But it was exciting. It was very exciting to see that they did this launch and that Elon Musk chose South By to go and reveal the footage and show what was going on. And it's crazy, exciting times.
And of course he is lobbying, the government, the state government of Texas for different regulations. I believe he tweeted out that he was doing a bit of lobbying in the capital of Austin before the keynote at South By, but just amazing work. I mean, you know, it is fascinating to see where he is. And granted, I know there are people listening. Hey, breaking news: the Weird Things podcast loves Elon Musk at SpaceX. But I'm sorry, when this stuff keeps coming out, I mean, it was amazing to see. We're about to start the NSFW event there at South By, and it just really, it floored me, just the vision of the future of ships taking off and landing in the same way that, you know, I mean, I fly, you know, two or three times a week now, that with the regularity that we think of air travel now, is just fascinating. you know, we can survive anything that happens to Earth because of the evolutions in you know, our spacefaring technology that is happening before our eyes, which is just amazing.
Speaking of the Earth, there's a video up. It's a presentation by Mr. Matt Ridley, excuse me, Dr. Matt Ridley, or Viscount Matt Ridley, and he's speaking to the Reason Foundation, and it's pretty interesting. He's talked about, in the video, he talks about how the research from is coming out that shows that the Earth has gotten greener in the last 20 years.
Okay. Now, just
we have this idea,
like lush vegetation, there is more of it on the Earth?
Yep. And the reason is, and we have this idea that because of the growth of technology, our use of fossil fuels, et cetera, that we're browning the Earth, that we're going to look like some sort of dusty environment. But he shows in the last 20 years, the Earth has gotten significantly greener than it has been before. And he cites a number of reasons for this. And it's counterintuitive to a lot of people. A lot of people have trouble accepting this idea. And a couple of things come into play. And one of the things it has to do with is that as you get an increase in CO2, which there is, you can actually measure. We know it's no rational person disputes that CO2 has gone up in the atmosphere. You can do tests to find this out. When plants have more readily available CO2, their pores don't have to open up as much to take it in. And because of that, they don't lose as much moisture. And that's one of the reasons why areas will tend to have some plant life and then it dries out and then it goes away, is they lose moisture too quickly and you're not able to sort of maintain the little ecosystem that it needs to stay nice and growy, whatever a plant likes.
Yeah.
And it's neat. I highly recommend checking out the video. And he talks about how this is part of one of the things from accelerated technology. We have this idea of just, oh, it's all bad, it's all bad. But we farm on 1/3 of the area of the farmland we used to use per, you know, 100 people or so 50 years ago. We're able to be much more effective in the amount of farmland we use, which means we have to cut down less rainforest and these much more dense vegetated environments. And basically, he talked about the idea that we've reached this point of peak farmland, the idea that we won't need to farm any more land to feed our population. We have all the land that we need for farmland, and we're eventually going to probably maybe slightly decline as we become even more efficient in farming.
Wow.
Which leaves...
So that would be scalable to wherever our population eventually goes. I mean, as our population continues to grow, that, you know, like we've just hit, you know, a line on those, you know, the curve of us being efficient will only become better even as we need to produce more food.
Now, the one hitch right now as far as our use of farmland comes to biofuels and the idea that we'll take palm oil or corn, whatever, to produce these kinds of fuels. And now that consumes about 5% of our food supply, which is part of the reason we have costs. That's basically one of the biggest reasons why food costs have gone up, is because of using it as food. And it's using food as fuel, which, one, it's not really any greener. It doesn't do anything other than subsidize those industries. And that's sort of a problem. If you want to stop the deforestation of rainforests, then don't do that. Don't incentivize the idea of raising more land when we don't need it, when we could just leave it as forests and rainforests, et cetera.
Well, I mean, the good news is that if you do want to fill up your ethanol vehicle car, you can go down to the end of my block. I think it's the only one I've ever seen in my life, but apparently they do exist. I mean,
it's
terrible. They're a terrible idea, and they're ridiculous.
Oh, I say, yeah, but I mean, most places your ethanol is in all, you know, gas supplies now.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. You know, when you go to pumps, like I forget, you know, where, like which states, whatever, it's mandated. But yeah, a lot of places you go to, and it's 5% ethanol by content. It's very, very common.
Is that going to be a relic of the aughts? Is that just going to be something that we mark, like, you know, like do you remember the ethanol cars?
Well, again, it's not going away. It's still there. It's still very, very. You know, you go to some places and you have to put ethanol, you know, they mix it with, it's an additive, and you can't buy fuel without it. It's mandated, and that isn't going away anytime soon. It's government mandated. There's a whole incentivization structure built upon it, a subsidy, everything else that goes into play. And it's one of those things where whenever there's a lot of money involved, it's hard to, in a collusion between government and businesses, these things tend to stick around. We're still paying subsidies for oil that were passed 100
100 years ago. Now, arguably, if you got rid of those subsidies, gas prices would go up. So it's not like it's just, you know, easy cause and effect where you just get rid of it and then we don't have to have that money go out of, you know, taxation or whatever. But in the case of ethanol, it's clearly something that's bad for engines and it is bad for the environment. Although it was passed as something good, but really was a way to say, hey, let's take another industry and find a way to find another use for it that we can get a higher price for it and not have to pay attention to market forces.
That's the last time I let Willie Nelson determine my energy policy. I swear to God.
It gets even crazier. In the video, Ridley talks about how in Britain they're actually building wood-fired power plants. They're building power plants that we power by wood.
Well, that seems
and they have them already in there. And they're importing the wood from California even. And he says that the rate of production that they're going and building these wood-fired power plants in, I guess, 5 years or so, there will be more power plants in Britain than there will be sustainable forest in Britain to power them. And they already have to import wood from elsewhere. And the theory is that these are sustainable. And he says, you know, they're sustainable. Listen, you know, it's not like coal. It's going to run out. It's this wood. We can always grow more trees. Well, he shows a very good example. He shows the island of Hispaniola, which is where you have Haiti in the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Republic, they actually subsidize propane. They actually encourage people there to use propane instead of cutting down trees because natural gas is abundant. We have hundreds of years supply of natural gas. We're not going to run out of it anytime soon. Haiti, there's no such program there. There's nothing like that. People chop down trees. In Haiti, something like 99%, 98% deforested. You look at the Dominican Republic on a map, and it's on a satellite map, and it's green. It's very, very green and vegetative. And it's the same island, two different structures. One says, hey, let's use these, quote, renewable trees, and there are no more trees. The other one says, well, let's use this fossil fuel, propane, and different situation. These things are complex, and it's not an argument to say that we need to pollute our environment or do anything like that at all. But it's the idea of unintended consequences. Very often there are people telling you, no, this will happen. This other thing, which maybe has the idea that it's going to be greener or whatever, maybe it won't really be that. Maybe there are these other reasons, there are these trade-offs. And as we go from inefficient to more efficient systems, generally things tend to get better.
And the problem, as always, when you're dealing with any kind of scientific question, is you just don't want to let dogma of any variety kind of cloud.
Either end. Absolutely. And that's what gets frustrating is it there tends to be sort of a shouting match between people who, one, think that we can't do any damage to this planet, and then the other people who think that the best case scenario is for us all to take a suicide pill. And it's not to say that the truth is in the middle necessarily, but you just have to understand that you have to. It depends on what your value system is. I'm a person who loves people. I like the idea of a planet with a lot of people. I like the idea of us being able to create a civilization that could have 10 times as many people as we have, maybe on Earth, off Earth, whatever. I think more people means more creativity, more awesome, more cool things to entertain me. And sustainability, I think, is we're far more capable of sustaining than what a lot of the people in the conservation movement would give us credit for. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that it's consequence-free if we do this without thinking.
Certainly so. Well, Andrew, you want to know what's better than a suicide pill?
No. What? What can possibly be better than a suicide pill? Cherry-flavored suicide
Area
pill?
Area 1851. Let me tell you about this. Aliens have landed in the Wild West, interrupting settlers on their way to Oregon. The aliens want a genuine human artifact and willingly trade dangerous technology for common household goods. A curious tribe of Native Americans has camped near the town and joined in the trading as aliens and humans begin tinkering with each other's gadgets, creating amusing attractions and spectacular failures. Area 1851 is an exciting new table game which players keep track of cards, roll dice, and deal with random events while trying to prove that they are the best tinkerer in town. Folks, it's a Kickstarter campaign because you haven't heard the word Kickstarter enough this week. It is, you know, the amazing platform is back to bring you one more treasure. It's Area 1851. Starts March 15th, so the day that this podcast goes live, you will be able to go and support it, and continues to April 16th. The goal amount is $30,000. People can go to Area 1851 for more information. Area1851.com for more information. And once the Kickstarter starts, you will be redirected right to the campaign. You can also like 5, that is F-I-V-E, numbers 24 labs, 524 labs on Facebook, or follow at FIVE number 24 labs on Twitter. Now, let me just tell you about this guy, Justin, who bought this ad. He is sponsoring the Weird Things podcast for the next couple weeks for the duration of this Kickstarter. And I'll tell you what, I think it's a great idea. You know, the tabletop movement is something that I know has, you know, just delighted me over the last year and a half, the more and more that I've gotten into it. And I can't wait to get my hands on this thing. I hope it's a reality.
I think it's great. I love the premise of that. I think it's a really neat concept. And the thing too, when you think about a tabletop game, it's not just you're getting into a way to sort of, it's a whole new experience you can have with your friends. And every time somebody spends a lot of time coming up with a game or environment like this, it's a story, it's an interactive story in a very, very cool way. And there's no way to predict the kind of fun or the quality of fun you're going to have with your friends other than you will have it. And I'm very excited.
Well, and also, let me just let you guys know this. I mean, this ain't Indiegogo, man. This is a Kickstarter. So it's 30K or bust. If you like the sound of that idea, then go ahead and head on over there right now. It is area1851.com.
Very cool. So, Justin, I want you to imagine your name is Justin Robert. You're a businessman, a Quebecy businessman, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Going about your business.
Okay, as I want to do. Uh-huh.
Maybe you don't have time for a relationship. Maybe the relationship you have is... maybe not as fulfilling as it could.
I am a businessman. I have no time for love.
You get an email. It says, "Oh, Mr. Justin Robert, my name is Sasha. I'm from Ukraine."
Man, there are times I really wish we had chicks on this show.
Yes. My name is Sasha. I'm from the Ukraine.
All right, Sasha. Hey, do not...
I love the way you mangle the French language. It is so awesome.
Yeah, growing up in Quebec, it is so easy to mangle the language.
Now, I know what you're thinking. It's email. Is Sasha real?
This seems like a flight of fancy.
Well, let's cyber chat, because that's what people in other countries still call it.
Dear Sasha, how can you prove to me you are a real girl?
Boom, you're in Skype. There is Sasha.
How does Sasha look to me? Justin
Sasha's
Robert?
Good looking. Sasha's good looking, and she shaves under her armpits.
Sasha, do me a favor. Move your head back and forth and rapidly answer my questions.
Certainly. Sasha's happy to do this. Sasha's, you're talking to Sasha. They're a little bit of a language barrier.
Huh. Right?
Okay.
Would you like to get married?
She says, "Hey, listen, why get married? We can have all the fun right now." Sasha says, Sasha, next thing you know, takes off her shirt. Sasha,
whoa,
naked in front of you.
This is a very adult episode of Weird Things, all right, podcast.
She's like, "All right, Jean Robert, why don't you show me something, right?"
Okay, but I take off my shirt.
All right. And we'll let people's imagination go from there. Soon you're engaging in some sort of...
salacious activity.
Yes, yes, with the lovely exotic Sasha in remote country. Like, this is fun. And next time you get together, you do it again. You're like, this is great, right?
Okay.
What could possibly go wrong?
I mean, this sounds shockingly like many relationships that I'm sure many listeners right now can attest to, that you're dating long distance. You rely a lot on Skype and things like FaceTime. This sounds perfectly above board. I'm, in fact, for one, very excited that Justin Robert was able to find true love in the Ukraine.
I'm glad you're happy with that. And I noticed that you're a little bit curious at first. You're doing some sort of idiot Turing test.
Yes.
Move your head back and forth. All right. Must be a human, because no machine can do that. Which I like the idea that perhaps that's how Skynet's going to pay for itself. It, it's going to create a bunch of sex bots that are going to try and to entice us into some sort of online digital prostitution.
I mean, I'll tell you what, it really puts a new spin on the term spear phishing.
Yes. So started off in, I guess, Quebec, and then it happened in Singapore. A number of businessmen found themselves approached by attractive young ladies who wanted to engage in cyber sex, and these men followed on. Were sure, why not? Their first thing is like, ah, you're not going to fool me. It's probably some dude. Nope, not a dude. It's a girl. Well, this is great. All right, what could go wrong here? And then they get an email. It says, listen, I have recorded every single one of our sessions. If you don't pay up, I am going to go public with this.
Wow.
Send it to the news so your friends, everybody will know. Everybody will see what you did online.
So, I mean, initially, like, even if you're thinking, like, I mean, like I was, like, or sorry, not me, Houston Robert, it was some sort of machine or something. This is actually just a extortion scheme from random ladies in the Ukraine.
Yeah, exactly. You're thinking, what would be my worst fear? Oh, it'd be some dude pretending to be a chick. It gets worse.
Wow. And so was this a ring? I mean, I guess at some point in any kind of blackmail extortion scheme, the key is somebody has to just, you know, show their rear end, you know, that they have to take the hit on all that information coming out to avoid, you know, paying forever, right?
Well, they had, it turned out there was one woman in Quebec who had gotten five men involved in this, and then Singapore, apparently there was a ring of this. So remember, this is one woman can keep herself busy and get several of these men involved in this. And apparently one of the gentlemen in Quebec, trying to get him to pay up, they even sent the videos to the Canadian Broadcasting Company in order to pressure him.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you what, she should have known better, man.
You can't embarrass a French Canadian, though. That's the mistake.
Yeah, Quebec is Montreal's a weird town, man. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes down in, you know, Crescent Street. It can be a dirty place.
So
that's amazing. So, I mean, this is just, I mean, I guess, like, the idea of compromising photos or, you know, some sort of compromising evidence used for blackmail is about as old as any piece of technology, right? Mm-hmm. But I guess maybe I'm just surprised these things haven't happened before.
I think it certainly takes a while for us to come to our attention. I think the idea of you get different kinds of scams. You get the really, really low-level ones, which are, hey, just try to sell you some bogus Viagra, whatever. Then you get ones where, hey, let me get your credit card number so I can kind of do a bunch of these small microtransactions. And this is a case where somebody said, hey, possibly a sex worker says, you know what, there's another way for me to make money because I can get these guys who have money. If I can get $5,000 or $6,000 out of each one of these guys and to work six or seven marks and to get them to pay up, it's $30,000 in just a few weeks' worth of work. So you get this other level of that. You go after people who would be professionally embarrassed by this, which would explain why you and I have not been approached.
Yes. Now, let me ask you this question.
We're going to release your sex tape if you don't pay up, okay? What's the downside?
Yes. So wait, hold on. You're gonna do all the emailing for me?
Yes. You'll put this online for me.
How many YouTube subscribers do you have? Let me ask you the question. What is the next step for this? I mean, if Skype has now made it mainstream enough that random lonely businessmen could be taken in by a scheme like this, where are we going from here?
I think the idea of we're seeing a lot of the
– Take notes, kids. The future of blackmail begins now.
Well, there's been a there was a recent incident with a guy who had the website where people would post photos of their ex-girlfriends or whatever and would charge a fee to have them removed. And that guy's going through all sorts of legal complications and because he's probably one of the worst people in the world.
Yes.
And we're certainly seeing this. We're seeing the people who have learned how to prey on others to make this stuff happen are coming to light. And I think that two things are going to happen. One, people maybe get a little little bit smarter, but we're always going to be emotionally vulnerable. In a situation like this, these people obviously trusted this girl. They thought that was okay. So I don't think people are all of a sudden going to stop taking their clothes off in front of cameras. What I think is going to happen, my prediction is this. We are seeing the evolution of when you see a photograph now, you don't know if it's real or not. Photography, you don't believe anything that's a photograph. Unless there's like a dozen photographs of a famous boxer dressed as a woman.
Yes.
Then you're kind of inclined to think that maybe this is real. But even then, it's getting harder. And if somebody really wanted to screw you over, they could Photoshop some stuff that looks sort of, you know, very, very realistic. It's easy to catch the hack jobs. The more sophisticated things are getting more complicated. And as we start moving into things like if you start using 3D technology to fake photographs,
yeah.
So you're actually able to get light and shadows and everything right, you can start creating stuff that is very, very hard for even an expert to date. Experts can look for all the telltale things, but when you get into more complicated stuff, there are people in universities and government research facilities right now who can create photographs that an expert would not be able to tell from the real thing because it's created in a virtual environment with that degree of sophistication. And what I'm getting to...
Not like that Grand Theft Auto character from the remake of The Manchurian Candidate either. Like, actual things.
Yeah, so we're going to get to the point where you look at what you can do on your iPhone or your Android phone. You can do Photoshop. You can create a lot of fake things. You can already paste your face onto a 3D actor, and that's getting more sophisticated. You're going to get to the point, what I'm getting at is, there's going to be a point where... Whether you like it or not, Justin, there is going to be a Justin Robert Young sex tape out there.
Sure.
You may have had absolutely no hand in creating it, but somebody took 20 minutes of footage of you on an NSFW show and got enough visual images of your face from different angles, whatever, and was able to paste that onto a 3D actor and then have you do a bunch of horrific things.
Well, there's only one way to combat it. Be the first to market. First mover advantage,
exactly.
Andrew.
Don't let the imitation be first. And that's what we're going to get to is going to be in a future where there are going to be so many fakes, so many things out there that if something is real gets released, we won't know. You won't know. You won't care, whatever. I think that's going to happen is we're going to get a couple high profile like releases of, you know, some famous actress or something like that that's going to look like it's real, and then it's going to turn out that they were actually fakes. And once that moment happens, once we get a big public release like, oh, guess who's, you know, naked online now, and it turns out that they're fakes, and there needs to be a technological leap for the average person or the average prankster to have the capability to do that. Once that happens and we find out that it is a fake, every time something like that happens, we're going to go, well, maybe it's a fake, and maybe it's a fake. And when it comes to a level where it's easy to do that with the average person, then we're not going to believe anything ever again.
But there would have to be,
in a good way.
I mean, because there are, you know, blips of like, you know, guess who's naked, and then it turns out it's a Photoshop. But those are like, you know, 8-hour, 12-hour kind of blips on blogs and stuff like that. This would have to be something where it was so real that everybody, I mean, that it was like, let's say theoretically a famous boxer who was photographed many, many times in women's clothing and then continued to insist that he didn't do it. It would be as if he wasn't actually lying.
Mm-hmm.
Like it would have to be that level of like, oh, wow. Like somebody comes forward and says, no, I did create all these photos. Here's how I did it. Or, you know, we would have to, you know, find on some level proof that we had wrongfully made a assumption about, you know,
I think that might be what, if you were somebody who had some next generation technology for making super realistic photographs that were hard to prove were false, that would be one way to do it. It would be to go get some public figures, yeah, maybe deceased Marilyn Monroe, whatever.
Exactly. Ruin some golden boy's reputation.
Exactly. You look at the commercial that came out with the Audrey Hepburn.
Yes.
Where they did a 3D model reconstruction of her. And it's interesting watching the people analyze it. Say, yeah, well, here this looked kind of fake or this, whatever. And I say bully to them. I thought it was seamless. And I think that if nobody knew where it came from, you would assume that it was real.
I guess, are we just climbing out the other end of the uncanny valley? You know,
well, there was a TED talk by a researcher who showed some really fascinating technology where they're able to make a 3D version of a woman, live actress. They recorded her face from just 100 different points, created a 3D model, and had that model speak and do things. And it would put it in a realistic environment, and you could not tell tell it from the real thing. And that was using very sophisticated computing systems to do that. The amount of time that it took to create that was a bit beyond the average smartphone user right now, but it is coming. And so I would say that, and that's the same before, we have at the high end, we have passed that. We have passed that uncanny valley.
Man. So, all right, I guess I'll get to work. I'll have to put that sex tape up sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Clock's ticking.
Listen, man, it's losing value as we speak.
Oh, jeez. Jeez.
So, Mr. Young.
Yes.
Let me scroll through here the list of topics. And I notice, I don't know if you got the news today, but apparently in Rome, Vatican City, actually, some guy got a job.
P-O-P-E. You know I'm an Argentine. I'm the Pope. Big announcement. First Pope from the Americas, first Pope who comes from the Jesuit order, for whom I've actually gotten to know quite a bit about recently, because I've gotten the chance to meet Father Robert Ballister, who works at the Twit Network and is a fan of ours, as we are a fan of his. But yeah, I'll tell you what. I mean, it seems. I mean, listen. I'm not going to pretend like who the Pope is really matters to my daily life, because it really doesn't. But that being said, it's hard to ignore when a sixth of the world's population believes in a certain set of beliefs, and that this person is at the head of it. And it seems, you know, by all accounts, in the grand scheme of popes, like, he seems to be about as progressive as anyone's ever going to get in that office in the modern era. I guess that would be from everything that I've read. He seems like Jesuit order is you know a group of the Order of Jesus, which is vocational, and they run colleges like Gonzaga and Georgetown and stuff like that. So, I mean, it seems like, in my very limited analysis, like a pretty cool pick.
Yeah, you're always going to have the problem that the Catholic Church is going to try to elect the most Catholic guy they can find in sticking to Catholic doctrine. And every time there's a new Pope.
Because the job is, in fact, to be the most Catholic person on earth.
Exactly. And that's why there's always this, maybe we'll get a more liberal Pope. Well, the problem is, if you got to be the Pope, if you're to be the Pope, you have to have a certain view on the world, and that's kind of at odds with how a lot of, let's call us modern people, sort of view the world. And the best you can hope for is to say, okay, in the list of things that he's going to be very Pope about, let's hope the things that he can do the best good for, caring for the poor and looking after people who are perhaps in third world countries, speaking out against dictatorships, etc., and helping those people. Let's hope that it's a Pope that focuses on that.
And focuses on using the full power of the Catholic Church to not only, protect those inside of it, but also to focus on, the health and well-being of its parishioners.
Yeah. And there's we could go on and on about all the sort of conflict, but there's a lot to be said about there are some very well-intentioned people working within, in particular the Jesuit organization, who are a bridge to the third world and do a lot to try to help with immunizations and doing things to look after people that sort of time or progress has forgotten. And we could, argue about, the idea of preaching religion, et cetera, whatever. But when it comes down to it, if somebody is able to help bring in malaria and measles medications into small areas, then I think there's a justifiable excuse to say there is some value to what they're doing.
And now I'll just say this about the Jesuit order, because again, I don't know many Jesuit priests. I know one Jesuit priest in Father Robert Ballister. Over the last 48 hours, he has been on NPR, CNN, I believe. He's been doing a lot of local television inside the Washington, D.C. area. He's a fan of NSFW. He's a fan of the Diamond Club, which is the community that not only supports NSFW, but this podcast and many, many others. And he was dared by other Diamond Club members to, during his morning interview on a local Fox affiliate, to flash the Diamond Club symbol, a dare for which he paid off. While explaining the dichotomy of the roles that new Pope Francis will need to fill, illustrated it with the two fingers outstretched on either hand meeting in the middle. So that is, again, I know there's a lot of people that are going to be listening to this that, you know, we have a ton of skeptic and atheist listeners, of which I am a skeptic and an atheist. But at the same time, I know one Jesuit priest, and he's like the most awesome dude ever.
He can resist earthly temptation, but not peer pressure.
Yes, yes. Well, and like he wants to have fun. You know, it was a fun thing to do.
Well, he's an example I would cite as somebody who wants to do well and do good in this world. And whenever, and like you, I'm a non-believer. I don't. But I do believe that there are people who want to do good in this world, and they look around for what organizations or institutions they think will help them do this. And I respect that urge and that feeling to do that. And I think that there are a number of people who do well in those places. I think that organizations have their own sort of problem, but he's by all accounts is a pretty good guy.
And gotta be pretty pumped at the Twitter follower jump.
Yes.
You know, that's a big bump for that guy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, furthermore, I think, maybe with this Kickstarter boom, you know, maybe we can get some other. I mean, I don't know. Granted, they are like the biggest landholders in the world, but you know, maybe there's something here. Maybe there's a new digital pope waiting in the wings. I could only hope. And for all of our Catholic listeners, I think they would be, you know, more than welcome to see at least a technologically progressive pope in a way that, you know, Benedict was just, I think, kind of too old to really be.
Kickstarter. So,
yes.
Last topic I wanted to go over.
All right.
Veronica Mars, as everybody knows by now, has gotten like $1 billion worth of funding. People just rushed in to go save to help bring back the show in the form of a movie.
Uh-huh.
And I remember a certain Mr. Houston Robert was a big fan of it.
Huge fan. And I would always describe Veronica Mars in this way, that imagine a show that was where your main character, the main character, female protagonist, wakes up at a party and believes she is date raped. And she now needs to figure out, how this happened to her. She's the son of a sheriff. She uses all
She's the
skills.
Son of a sheriff.
Or sorry, daughter of a sheriff. Yeah, that would be a whole nother show. Daughter of a sheriff. She uses all of the skills at her disposal. Meanwhile, she has to track down her alcoholic mom. There's murders. A class division in this seaside California town. And at the end, just kind of mention. Oh, also, it's about a teenage girl. And one of the mysteries she's solving is why her boyfriend broke up with her. But I'll tell you what, for a show that handles genre noir fiction in the way that Veronica Mars did, while balancing the humor and the coming of age elements, I thought it was, you know, just a real spectacular example of that. And I was thrilled, like many, many others, you know, to just wake up after having, you know, really given up on the fact that there would ever be a movie or any kind of restart to the series 5-6 years after it was canceled, to just see, hey, is this possible? And then 12 hours later to have it be not only possible, but more than possible, that it's cleared its funding goal. And now, you know, the question is justifiably where, you know, not only where does this mean for Veronica Mars, but what does this mean for entertainment going forward? Not even just resurrecting old television shows as movies. You know, I think that there's a real question. My question to you, Andrew.
Okay, we'll blow right past my question.
Go right. Sorry, I'm sorry.
I was trying to I wanted to just bring up the Veronica Mars, but that is a very impassioned explanation for why they should watch Veronica Mars.
Sure.
But I think we're going to hit the same point, and that is seeing how successful, I think at the time of this recording, it's what, at 3 million? It blew past the 1 million, hit 2 million, and then now it's pushing towards 3 million. So it's going to be overfunded. And I think that when we listen to people complain and bitch about the shows we like going off the air.
Yeah.
And it's not there anymore. Meanwhile, we will defend illegally downloading and these other things which do not directly support these kinds of shows. Yeah. And if they do help them, the benefits from viewership, whatever, are so secondary and tertiary and hard to sort of figure out in a ledger. It's an exciting, exciting time. It's a very exciting time because we can bring back a show like Veronica Mars in the form of a movie. All these other properties that we think they're maybe untapped have a tremendous amount of potential. And we're watching this, and we talked about this earlier, is the idea that 2013 is a very exciting time. We saw the launch of House of Cards on Netflix,
yep.
Which is, it used to be that online content, episodic stuff was just things you could not sell anywhere else. You had these crappy TV shows that people tried, and they maybe went and got some money from some startup that just had more money than sense and was able to put money into these things, and they were very poorly produced. Now you're getting Netflix in the game of creating original content and paying a really good price for it, really, really good as a producing point of view. It's not trying to be doing it for low cost. This is HBO-level money or better. You have Microsoft.
Better, yeah, they outbid HBO, Netflix mm-hmm. did for House of Cards.
You have Microsoft getting into this game for its content networks, and now you have Amazon looking to do the same. And now that we have these platforms, these digital platforms that just exist outside of cable, Netflix, Amazon Prime, Xbox, what have you, it's an exciting time. And then to see this thing come out of nowhere, the Veronica Mars, and to think, man, we've talked about it before. We watched what happened with Dr. Horrible.
Yeah.
And then that guy, whatever happened to the guy who produced that and directed that, I don't know. No. But
cult favorite, though.
Yeah, he had to do, like, I don't know, like some sort of funny book movie or something. But in any event, this is an exciting time. And where do you want to see this go next?
Well, I mean, I think what is amazing about it is that it's limitless, you know, that the same platform is the thing that we can get a E-Ink watch. You know, as people who want to go see a Veronica Mars movie can throw into that, or that Richard Garriott can launch a new Ultima game, or that, you know, Area 1851 can make a card game based on Wild West alien trading, you know, of parts and services. Or let's say that Justin Robert Young and Tom Merritt can debut their FSL Tonight Kickstarter to bring a third season of the acclaimed fantasy sports podcast with an emphasis on fantasy to everybody ad free.
But what I was going to get at is the idea that this is the first time we've seen Warner Brothers. We've seen a big corporate entity go in and say, yes, if you can get the funding for this, if you can get this point, we'll let you use this property, because that's the Veronica Mars is owned by Warner Brothers. And yes. When you want to bring these sort of properties, and that's what I was getting at, is that that's what was the big game changers. We've had Kickstarter for a while now, and we've had these other kinds of projects. Now we get a big corporation who comes in, who owns these properties, and has said, okay, if you really think that there's a fan base for this and you think you can raise the money to do this film, then yes, you will have our blessing and we can produce this.
Now, I guess, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I mean, so let's take the Richard Garriott example.
Mm-hmm.
He did he's doing Kickstarter because he wants to do a game that he makes abundantly clear in the video. That is like, you know, I made all these versions of Ultima, and now I'm making to you Shroud of the Avatar. You know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, it's Ultima.
Mm-hmm.
This happens, let's say Richard Garriott launches this 6 months after the Veronica Mars thing, where now the idea of these rights holders saying, oh, well, you know, I mean, we're just literally sitting on this. You know, we might as well make some kind of money. If the financial burden can be less for us, then that makes more sense. Do you think it is more likely that Richard Garriott would have been making an Ultima game instead of a Shroud of an Avatar game?
I don't know. And video games are a lot different in that what made Ultima great back then isn't necessarily what would make Ultima great right now. And video games, every time they come out with a new version of it, you know, from Halo 1 to Halo 2, gameplay changes dynamically. It changes radically, rather. You have familiar characters, but you're not as invested in the characters as much as the environment. Yeah. And what's the difference on one level between World of Warcraft and some other, you know, Diablo or some other game that comes about? And there's, and people argue these things, but basically it comes down to is the thing that sells each new game is more the mechanics and how well thought out the universe is. With Veronica Mars, it's Kristen Bell as Veronica Mars. And we could have those people come out and do another movie, work together on something else, but it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
And I think that's you look back at, you know, when you have movies with great ensemble casts, and when, you know, A Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah.
Okay. Great movie, great cast, and they come back and they do, was it Fierce Creatures? It's like, it's they're fun moments, but we love The Fish Called Wanda because we.
Yeah, it ain't that first dance, you know.
Yeah, and I think that if we'd had another Fish Called Wanda, maybe it would have done better because it would have been, you know, we wanted to see more out of those characters, or maybe not. You know, it could have been bad. But I guess that's sort of the difference with video games, is that putting the Ultima label on it isn't the same as the, I guess, it's every new version has to be sufficiently different from what happened before. With movies and stuff, we kind of want the same thing, but just a little different.
Let me ask you this question. Because when the Louis C.K. thing happened, where he decided to sell his own special instead of selling it to HBO, a lot of people said, is this a game changer? And I think me and you, and I do believe that we've probably been proven correct as time has gone on, considering Louis C.K.'s next special is going to be debuting on HBO. People said it was a game changer. Now we have this Veronica Mars example that, again, people are saying it's a game changer. Is it more of a game changer than the example that Louis C.K. set? And if so, why?
Oh, it's way more of a game changer. And all respect to Louis C.K., but Louis C.K. was a guy that he had already achieved. You already had comedians recording their own albums, doing their own, making their own videos and selling this stuff. This is the first time we had a guy that had the benefit of multiple cable channels worth of exposure, Tonight Show exposure, whatever, who was already a guy who was one of the most famous comedians in the world, who already had a tremendous amount of social media presence to come along and do that. And I was very happy for his success of that, but I didn't take it as this sort of big, huge leapfrog, because it was not an indie success. This was a guy that was made famous because of the millions of dollars invested in helping him with his brand name through the different television products he's created.
But to be fair, Veronica Mars wouldn't be an indie success.
Oh, no, but what I'm saying, what the difference is here, I guess what the significantly different thing for me here is this, is that comedians have been producing things before, have been doing, recording their own specials, recording this sort of stuff before. What made this different is the idea of it's a big Warner Brothers coming in and saying, yes, we will participate. We will participate in this brand new form of financing. Instead of saying, we're going to try to find the money here, which we've already allocated, oh, we're still paying off Green Lantern, sorry, can't do this, or Thomas having to go out and solicit a bunch of investors and then saying, I've got the money men lined up to make this thing happen. I've sold the sequel, or sold the rights overseas or whatever. And it's a big, putting those sort of rights things together, it's our big, complicated, messy things. Here, go to the studio. We have permission to use this character, do a Kickstarter. Yes, that was a big leap. Now you have, it's, I guess to me, the big deal is the studio being willing to say, we will let you go out there with this licensed property and try to raise money for it to do this thing and get your financing from there as opposed to some other model.
I completely and totally agree. I think that's the big step, is that, I mean, this intellectual property otherwise just kind of rots. You know,
mm-hmm.
You know,
we talk a lot about,
we get upset if somebody were to sell Veronica Mars t-shirts with the name Veronica Mars on it. Warner Brothers would sue them because they have the rights on it. And it's their right to sue them. It's their right to protect that trademark. But I think that there is a frustration from fans who just want to see stuff done with it, you know, and this gives a new lease on life for a lot of these properties. Let me ask you.
You take a property like Buck Rogers. See, some people see like Buckaroo Banzai. Okay. Harvey, Buckaroo Banzai. Okay, Buckaroo Banzai has a cult fan following. The producer of that movie has tried over the years to bring it back in different forms, close to trying to get a TV deal, which fell through. Now, with the idea that, look at how Warner Brothers was very cool, they said, yes, this Veronica Mars, which looks like a success. The movie could suck, but the fundraising was a success. He can go out there now and say, hey, he can go present, make a very solid case to say, let me bring back this property. I'm going to go do a Kickstarter. If we raise the money, then great. It's funded. We can go do this. You'll have your stake in it. If not, then fine. I'll go away.
Yeah. And really, I mean, it is kind of like a put up or shut up moment for fans. Like how much do you want to mm-hmm. see it? You know, and are there enough of you to really make it possible?
Imagine Kickstarter 1969 after Star Trek had been canceled.
Yeah. Or, you know, Kickstarter in the fallow period for Doctor Who before the relaunch, you know, only a couple years ago. Like, you know, what would all of those properties have meant to the fans that obviously now in hindsight we know are massive, massive successes.
Well, the reason I brought up Star Trek instead of Doctor Who, Star Trek, he had Gene Roddenberry. So you had the one guy who was doing it. You know, when Doctor Who went fallow, the original creators were long gone, and it was almost like, you know, the BBC said, we have this, who cares?
Yeah. All right. Let me ask you one more question about this.
All right.
What do you say to people who say that Kickstarter as a concept is for projects that cannot get outside funding, and that it is tainted now, that it is used as the mechanism for already established corporate entities to just take more money directly from fans instead of serving their purpose, which is to take the financial risk on these kinds of projects so they happen?
One is that's one person's idea of how they perceive what Kickstarter is. I don't, and when we start talking about, well, corporations this, corporations that, and I know I've used that term, but I'm incorporated. Am I a corporation then? Is everything I do tainted by corporation? It's silly. It's a silly sort of thing.
I love nomenclature, because you take any of those arguments and like, let's replace Warner Brothers with Joe.
Yeah.
Joe put up the money for Veronica Mars. Joe lost a lot of money on Veronica Mars. Joe doesn't want to do a movie.
And that's what it comes down to, is when you take apart, Warner Brothers, actually right down the road from where I am right now. Warner Brothers is a big, big company, very large company. And this was a project that Warner Brothers Digital decided to do. And so there was somebody within Warner Brothers who had to champion us and say, let's make this thing happen. And so within these companies, you have people fighting for projects all the time. It's not the overmind. They're not all in agreement about this. They're fighting for stuff, trying to make things happen. There were people there that wanted to make Veronica Mars happen. But the problem is, it's a very big monolithic corporate structure. And they say, hey, we're spending our money in X, Y, and Z, and yeah, we're still paying off Green Lantern. We don't have the money to make this thing happen. And that's a decision made by somebody. Was it the right one or the wrong one? I don't know. But when we start saying that, oh, well, because Warner Brothers got involved here, now it's silly. It comes down to creators. If you're a creative person, you have an idea. One of the places, if you have the access, you're going to try to sell it to a studio. You're going to want to go there and try to do that, because if that's the place that has the money to make it happen, that's where you go. That studios can come in and kick Starter and raise money for projects is great. It's absolutely great, because it means that they're going to be more responsive to fans and more responsive to what we want. You know, I haven't gone to see a movie in like 3 weeks because there's been nothing in the theaters I want to see. Nothing. And I want to go see a movie tonight. There's nothing I want to see. There's nothing opening, you know, up. And I'll go see Burt Wonderstone because, you know, friends worked on that. But other than that, when you sit there and you go, oh, there's nothing to go see, it's because we're not having enough input. But now, because of getting big studios who have the infrastructure to make big projects, high quality projects happen, are getting involved in Kickstarter, it is great. Because it also means that, you know, if you're a little guy and you have a great idea for something, you get to be in the same sphere, in the same place with them. And you can, if your idea is strong, there's going to be people raising money and they're going to have trailers that are going to look better than what we're seeing from studios. And you're going to see the next generation of directors are going to come probably from Kickstarter.
It is a mind-blowingly exciting time. And, you know, I don't know anybody who, you know, had a lot of really, you know, big complaints about it that, you know, also put in a bunch of money. Because I know for me, I was very happy to put in $100 to see, you know, Veronica Mars happen. And I'm very happy with the haul I got for my $100, including the satisfaction that I was part of that original $2 million. It makes me very, very happy to do that personally. So I'm thrilled with it. I know, listen, there's a legitimate conversation about it and what it is going forward and what it means. I think that we can talk about it, but to think that Kickstarter as a concept is ruined is just really, really ridiculous.
It's silly. And if we say that we want to limit this kind of fundraising to only tiny little indie projects, we're never going to get the really high quality, the things that need bigger infrastructure, that need money to hire professional actors to work on a large scale and do things. We're never going to get those if we say, nope, we can only use this funding model for these tiny little things. And they can produce some good stuff, but when you want to do a really cool, and Veronica Mars is being done for a shoestring budget, but it's still a several million dollar project.
Yeah.
And the only, and
it's not like
if
Kristen
we want to,
Bell necessarily works for cheap. I mean, she'll work for cheap on this thing, but you know, and I do think that that is part of why this particular thing succeeded is that, you know, Veronica Mars was the first thing that Kristen Bell kind of burst on the scene with in terms of creating a beloved fan base for her. She's continued to become somebody that has, you know, a fairly high profile. You know, she's not like, you know, crazy A-list or anything, but like this was a uniquely ripe project to pop. I don't think that it is the only kind of project of its type to be able to do something like this, but I think it is. It was very well suited to do it.
Back in the 90s when the World Wide Web came about and all of a sudden you started getting big companies were buying domain names or buying domain names and we're going to get in there. People thought this was going to ruin it. This was going to be the end of the internet. This was just going corporate. Everything was cool about it. Maybe for some people, everything was cool about it. It's gone. It didn't hurt it one bit. It's in a much healthier place. And legitimizing crowdsourcing for big projects, I think, is only going to bring about good stuff.
Especially since it just registers a lot more people to Kickstarter. More people who are on Kickstarter.
Yep.
It means more people know about Kickstarter. It means more Kickstarters are going to get funded. Which I'll tell you what, I think that means we should bring into our pick segment.
Yes. I will let you go first.
Two things. Number one, see Robert Cargill. You might know him as Massaworm. On ain'titcoolnews.com, co-wrote Sinister, started reading his book Dreams and Shadows on a couple flights. I'm about a quarter of the way through, but I will say he is a very talented fantasy writer. And if you enjoy fantasies, changelings, monsters, interacting with the real world, I think you will be in for a treat with C. Robert Cargill's Dreams and Shadows. And I know that we did a run there, or sorry, I did a reading from Andrew's new book, Night School, on the podcast last week. Thank you to everybody who had great feedback on that. But I again want to let everybody know, Night School, available now. And I'll tell you what, I thought a lot about this book, and in large part because part of it, you know, Andrew is, as me and Andrew have talked about, you know, it's kind of based on a club that we were both in high school, albeit at different times, which is a Renaissance Recreation Society, right?
Mm-hmm.
The main character, I'll tell you what, I felt a great affinity for the main character, and not because I saw myself in him, but rather I saw somebody else that I went to high school with and was also in this Renaissance Recreation Society that I was a real asshole to. And I really, you know, it kind of affected me in a way that I really wasn't expecting it to. And I think it will have that emotional resonance with many of you, probably not in the same way that it was for me, but I'll tell you what, it's a story that stuck with me. I very much highly recommend everybody go ahead and pick up Night School.
Thank you, sir. It's interesting. I'm curious to see. I certainly incorporated people I knew into the book, but just different parts of their personalities and started kind of
yeah.
amalgamations of them.
I don't think that this particular person was somebody that you were thinking about when you were writing the character, but there were elements to it that we can talk about it afterward.
Yeah, interesting. So my pick is the Marvel Comics Unlimited app.
Oh, yeah.
I was so afraid you were going to pick that. I was about to just yell at you, and you're like, you have two picks. I'm like, no fair. You only get one.
No, I'll tell you what. I bought it when you first sent me the thing. I will explain what it is, and then I'll tell you why I haven't had a chance to find out how awesome it is.
So Marvel Comics has had a thing for a while called Marvel Unlimited, where if you go to the Marvel website, you pay a flat fee, either pay per month or per the year. You could read comics, digital comics online on the website using Flash, which is about the most horrifying, painful experience that I can possibly think of in my limited imagination.
Yeah.
And so I looked at that before. I said, well, I don't want to read stuff on my computer. I want to read it on my iPad. That is why God invented iPads. And so I was very frustrated by that. And I never signed up for it. But I like comics, but I can't. I'm one of these people that I call it my stack of shame. And this was when, the first Star Trek movie came out. Justin and I went into a comic book shop, and I just got on this kick. I just wanted to read some Star Trek comics. So I bought like a stack of Star Trek comics. And I have them sitting on my coffee table because I look at that, and it was the 9-year-old Andrew with money just going crazy buying stuff. And so I go through these sort of, I'll buy comics and then I'll feel shame because, you know, we're adults. We read fast. You pay $4 for a comic book. It's done in 7 minutes. Yeah. And then you're like, now what? And so I've never been able to kind of reconcile my love of comics for my shame for that. Well, toyed with the idea of Marvel Unlimited. It's nah. And then finally they came out with it for the iPad. They unveiled the Marvel Comics Unlimited app. And what it is you can pay something like $10 a month or $60 for the year, $60 for the year. And they have over 12,000 comic books on that. You're talking all your major titles going back to the start. They add new stuff every week, and it's basically new up until about 6 months ago. So, you know, you have to wait 6 months for the newer titles to come in there, which is totally fair. And there is a ton of stuff. I probably read way more than my $60 worth of comics in the first afternoon I had the app. So it's for the iPad. It's for the iPhone. It's a little bit buggy, but it's, again, $60 to subscribe for the year. And which I said, let me just go ahead and straight up and do that. And I've been reading a ton of titles. Just ton, you know, great for like series like the Marvel 1601 series. They've got the Fantastic Four Future Foundation. They've got their own kind of Watchmen stuff. There's just tons of stuff where you saw these comics in the shop and you thought, maybe I want to read that, but man, I don't know if I want to, you know, spend $20 or whatever on this run and be kind of like meh about it.
Yeah. Well,
can't recommend enough.
Couple notes. Number one, that $60 for the year price is, as Swearingen would say in Deadwood, getting to know you prices. That is an introductory offer. So I do recommend, if you are interested in this, to go ahead and get that now, because who knows how much it'll last. And the reason why I haven't read a lot is because the search functionality I found a little bit confusing, and specifically in terms of where I would want to start a run of you know, a storyline or something like that. And I very much agree with an idea that you texted me, which is, I think someone needs to step up and do a Tumblr of recommendations with just the full titles of the comic and which issue to start on, because I would very much like that. It's just awesome recommendations from people who know comics far more than I, that I would really, really, really like to read in this super easy and economical format.
Yeah, I would second that with a caveat, but I'll say this. Marvel does have, on their website, if you go to digital, they do have where to start once you're in the Marvel Comics Unlimited, and they tell you which runs and which stuff you might want to pay attention to.
Okay, good.
And when I've had friends make recommendations for runs of stuff, the problem is that some people are very, very passionate about stuff and like, oh, you'll love this run. But and the problem with comic books is they're so serialized and they're so picking up. You know, Marvel did a thing where they restarted a number of their series back to issue number one. They didn't start the storylines over. And So you look at the number one and it's like, oh, so-and-so's moved in here and there, you know, has old wounds come to the surface. Like, wait, how is
is number one. How is this possible? Which seemed to be more of a marketing gimmick than trying to make things simplified from a storytelling point of view. I heartily agree. And so, yeah, I think it would be great to have somebody do that. They just have to be a comic book fan that knows how to talk to people like you and me who haven't spent as much time keeping up with these things and understand where it begins and ends. I've had friends recommend runs to me.
That's all I'm looking for.
Yeah, I have friends that recommend runs to me, and I pick these things up, and I'm just like, I'm missing out on, this would mean a lot more if maybe I'd started 40 issues back.
All right.
So I've been going for sort of the miniseries. That's been sort of my favorite.
Awesome.
Marvel Comics Unlimited. That's it. So, any last words?
FSL Tonight Kickstarter. Search for
that. Yes. I signed up.
Thank you.
I don't know if you know that, but yes. I already got in on my FSL Kickstarter.
There we go. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I think I signed up for the, awkward hug from Justin Robert Young.
Oh, you get those for free.
Oh, well. All right. In the awkward, it's just a little extra sauce. All right, buddy. It's been weird.
Sponsor the podcast? Do you have $30? If so, go to weirdthings.com/sponsor and you can have Justin say whatever you want. He's a trained ape.